little bit prosaic. I don't have any cosmological results or new facts about the universe to tell you, but I want to tell you about what should be an important step to getting there. And the approach that I am describing today is something that Bob Armstrong, Marisa March, and Christina Krawick at Penn have been working on, and Bob is now at Princeton. Okay, so first I'm going to take a couple minutes to try to sell you on gravitational lensing if you're not already sold. And I'll breeze through this, so my apologies, this will not be a complete description. But gravitational lensing, right, the deflection of light by traveling down the null geodesics of spacetime is described by the projected gravitational potential on the sky, which is an integral between us and whatever we're looking at, the source, of the actual 3D gravitational potential or scalar components of the perturbations to the metric, if you want to think of it that way, down the line of sight with these distance, angular diameter distance factors here. Okay. So if we could measure this thing, and we can show you, it's extremely useful for astrophysics and cosmology. Right. So one thing that you can do, for instance, is since you know that the metric, the potential is sourced by the matter, you can make a map of the matter if you have the potential. And you can learn things about the relation between the total matter, all the gravitating matter, and the visible parts. And just some examples, so here is one of the very first papers doing something like that. This is from the young Mike Hudson, and this is using the Hubble Deep Field data. He was able to show that by combining all the bright foreground galaxies that you could see a gravitational lensing distortion called shear, which I'll explain in a moment, which was significantly detected in the vicinity of visible galaxies. Right?
This was a Desmond who used to make his talks to seminars on time, I guess.
And then here's another one that you've probably seen, right? Same science category in a sense. This is 2006 from Doug Clough and Company. And this is the famous bullet cluster where the lensing mass inferred is in the blue regions, but most of the baryonic mass is where the hot X-ray gas is in the red. And so here's a nice demonstration that there is non-baryonic matter. And then the last one I'm going to show is from today. This was actually released yesterday. This is from my main project, the Dark Energy Survey, that me and a couple hundred of my friends are working on right now to survey 5,000 square degrees of the sky. And you'll see in a few moments why that's good for gravitational lensing. This is a inferred mass map from gravitational lensing observations of about 150 square degrees on the sky from our first test observations that we took. This is about 3% of the area of data that we will acquire, or actually it's about 3% of the area that we already have in the can. So the color scale is showing the inferred matter distribution projected along the line of sight. And the little gray circles are the locations of clusters of red galaxies, right? And so you can see here quite stunningly that the places where there's a lot of matter are the places where there's a lot of galaxies, and then you have voids like this, which are also, they're deficient in matter, but they are also deficient in galaxies. So this is just a visual impression here that shows you that this works.
These are
the cognoscenti would call the red mapper clusters, right? These are the, the LRGs. And we'll be doing more of this. And so this one uses about a million galaxies in the background, right? So, here, before your name disappears from the screen. So that's one thing that you can, you know, if you can see the gravitational potential somehow, you can infer the mass and you can do a lot of astrophysics understanding the relation between mass and light. Another thing that you can do is this gravitational potential is, of course, the descendant of the fluctuations that we see in the cosmic microwave background maps. And if we can measure the amplitude or the power spectrum of those fluctuations in the present day universe, then we can compare the growth from the recombination era to today, right? And compare that to the standard perturbation theories of in general relativity and learn about potential deviations. And here's kind of the state of the art of that so far. This is from the Canada, France, Hawaii Lens Survey. This was published a couple years ago. This is from 150 square degrees containing about 5 million galaxies. And this black line here is some measure of the two-point correlation function of matter in the universe. And from it, they can constrain this combination of cosmological parameters, sigma 8, essentially the amplitude of the mass spectrum, to about 4% accuracy. Okay. And then one other thing I'll point out is that there's this combination of distances, angular diameter distances here, in the expression for the lensing potential. And if we can map out these, we can measure these ratios of distances, and because the angular diameter distance is determined by the expansion history of the universe, gravitational lensing can also be used to make very accurate measures of the expansion history, and hence the dark energy or whatever is going on to drive that. Okay, and there have we have not yet reached the precision where that's really competitive yet, but we expect to very soon from the dark energy survey, among other ongoing experiments. All right, so I hope in 3 minutes you're convinced that this would be a really nice thing to be able to measure this potential. All right, here's a picture of the sky, and this is what the talk is about. If you see this picture of the sky, can you tell me if it's been lensed and how much, right? What does this picture tell you about that potential? How do you go from a picture to of the things you can see to the potential of the things you can't? All right, so let's just think about that potential. First of all, if I change the potential itself, what's the manifestation? The observable manifestation, well, it actually, just if I add potential to the scene, I delay the arrival of the photons by a little bit. And since the universe does not change significantly on the year or so, whatever time scale of the delay, you can't tell that they've been delayed because you can't, you know, remove the mass from the universe and see what time the signals would have arrived without the mass there, right? So unfortunately, time, the universe is almost time invariant, at least on human time scales, and so delaying the light is not observable. Yeah.
Could you imagine being a real time, like a lensing version of redshift,
right? Well, you can certainly do redshift drift. I'd have to think if there's an observable case where you can do that. The one case where you can use this is what's called strong lensing, where you have two images of the same thing that travel different paths, and then you can measure the differential potential that way, but I'm going to talk about cases. I'm not going to talk about those rare cases. Yeah. Okay, so you can't actually measure this in most cases. What about the first derivative of the potential? The first derivative of the potential is a shift of galaxies on the sky. It's just a displacement. And again, because the universe is translation invariant, I cannot tell whether a part of the sky that I'm looking at has been shifted from its original position. Well, that's what they say, but I don't think they're right about that. Maybe we'll have that argument later. So this, because the universe is translation invariant, if you just shifted, if you took the whole CMB sky and rotated it, you wouldn't be able to tell if it's lensed. Right?
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the first one.
Yeah. Oh, Sachs-Wolfe effect, right. Yeah, that is a case, right, where the time delays are so significant that you actually can tell. Right, that's a good point, yeah. Okay, so this doesn't work, but it's at the second derivative that you hit the jackpot, where the second derivative of the gravitational potential corresponds to a stretching of the image, right? It's a gradient of the shift across whatever you're looking at. And that does break a symmetry that the universe has, which is isotropy. So if you see that a certain region of the sky does not have isotropic rotational symmetry anymore, we can infer from that the presence of lensing, and we can try to measure the second derivative. And of course, up to a couple of constants of integration, measuring this is as good as measuring these two. Okay, you could ask, what about more information? So there are third derivatives, which cause something that people call flexions. And you can measure those too, but it turns out that the by, I think, a pretty large measure in most circumstances, most of the information that you can gain by looking at the sky is in these second derivatives. So let's focus in on that a little bit more. Okay, so that second derivative of the potential turns into a first derivative of displacement. That is to say, if you take the position where you see something and the derivative of that with respect to the position where it would be if there were no lensing between you. So this is a two-dimensional quantity, two-dimensional qualities. So we have this Jacobian derivative matrix, and it's usually written this way with the trace part called kappa, and then the symmetric traceless parts described by gamma 1 and gamma 2, which are called the shear. Okay. And for reasons we don't have to get into, sometimes we write this with G. It's called the reduced shear instead, which is actually the observable quantity. So if you had a circular galaxy and your second derivative had a non-zero gamma 1, that turns into a galaxy that's elongated a bit in the x direction. If you have a positive gamma 2 in your derivative, second derivative of your potential, you get something that's elongated at a 45 degree different angle. And if you have a non-zero kappa, you actually magnify. Okay, so this is called magnification, and these two are called shear. And measuring any of these would allow you to reconstruct the gravitational potential, the projected potential. Okay, so how can we now, I want to pose a problem. We have some data D, which is an image of the sky, a set of pixel values. And we want to ask, what can we infer about the probability of that image having had a certain distortion from lensing? And I'm going to use the shorthand G here to stand for all three of those second derivatives, gamma 1, gamma 2, and kappa, or G1, G2, and kappa. Okay, so G is just lensing, and D is your image. All right, so we want to look for these distortions. So we need some kind of background wallpaper to that emits photons that we can look at, see distorted. So this lensing has been successfully measured with two different kinds of wallpaper now. One is to actually use the cosmic microwave background itself as a wallpaper. And that's really great because, first of all, you know exactly where it is. It covers the whole sky. It's been detected. What's even better is that you know an awful lot about the pattern of the light coming from the CMB because you have a prior theoretical knowledge that it should be a Gaussian random field, and you even know what the power spectrum of that Gaussian random field should be. And there's actually three fields, right? There's a temperature, an E, and a B mode, and you know that two of them, the T and the E, are Gaussian random fields, and the B polarization field is zero before it was lensed. So the fact that you know so much about that distribution of the light on the CMB means that you can derive essentially optimal estimators for the lensing distortions that they underwent. And that's been done. Okay, so in some sense, because it's been done, I will call it easy. And if you actually want to know how it's done, I couldn't actually tell you that, but I think Kendrick would be the person to ask, for example. So I'll have nothing. Oh, I didn't finish my sentence. Nothing further to say I was going to write. Okay. it's not that this is nothing. It's extremely valuable. And there are very high significance detections of lensing in, for instance, the Planck data. Okay, the other kind of wallpaper that I am going to talk about is the kind like I showed you before, that Hubble Deep Field image, where we're going to look for the distortions of individual galaxy images. And you could ask, why are you bothering if this is already done? And there are two good reasons. One is that there's much more structure in the visible sky with these galaxies than there is in the CMB. And that means that there is more lensing information to be extracted from it in principle. And the other thing is that the sources of the light are at, you know, a variety of redshifts between us and redshift 6, whereas with the CMB, you only have one source that's at redshift 1,000. And so what that means is that you can use this, or especially this, in combination with this, to map out the growth, the time history of the gravitational potential, which is also extremely valuable for cosmology. All right, so let's talk about how you would take a picture of a bunch of galaxies and decide how it had been distorted by lensing. Well, as I mentioned, the thing that lensing has done that you should be able to observe is to break the isotropy of the sky. And it's changed from having pure rotational symmetry to having kind of a quadrupole symmetry, right? That the stretching, those second derivatives behave in a certain way, like a spinner quantity. So what you would want to do is find something that you can assign to your galaxy that has the same kind of symmetry as the shear does. And that we will call the shape of the galaxy. Because one thing that behaves like these second derivatives is, for instance, the ellipticity of an ellipse. An ellipticity has two components, E1 and E2, right? And they transform as you rotate the sky like a polarization does. Spinner. So if you can assign two quantities, which sometimes they're called E1 and E2, here they're E plus and E cross, which correspond to those two different modes of stretching. Okay. Then the unlensed sky, this is supposed to be a surface plot or a contour plot of the distribution of galaxy ellipticities in the unlensed sky. And we can see that it's symmetric about the origin because the unlensed sky is rotationally symmetric, right? But if I were to have applied some stretching to that part of the sky, then each individual galaxy would have shifted a little bit, and the total distribution also shifts, and you can see it ends up off center here, right? So the difference between the lensed sky and the unlensed sky is this shape, right? So if you can look for this shape in the distribution, measure essentially the mean of the E's, right? That will tell you what the applied lensing is, right? Now, the symmetry alone tells you that you got the direction of the stretching correct. You may have the amplitude a little bit wrong, and that's why I put this responsivity factor R in here that you have to figure out, okay? Now, the other kind of lensing that I mentioned is magnification. And to my knowledge, magnification does not break any symmetry that the sky has, right? So it's not clear where you would go with that, and we'll get back to that later. All right.
How do you distinguish
Yeah, that's definitely present. And we call that intrinsic alignment, which is where the galaxies are aligned because they know something about each other, or they lie in the same filament or whatever. And so the main trick that you would have to use to distinguish that effect from the true lensing is that the galaxies will only physically align when they are at the same distance from you, right? That they could have been close enough to each other. But if you see one galaxy that's far in the background from another and those align, that's much harder to produce, right, with an actual astrophysical mechanism. So there's a redshift dependence that, this is a whole other topic, but we do have to worry about that.
So the first picture is starting with symmetric. The second one is you have an actual symmetry, like a spin.
Yes, right.
And then the third one is what?
Well, this is just this one minus this one to show you what this is, kind of the signal of lensing that you would be looking for, right? Yes. Right. It's at the few percent level, which, as I'll show you in a moment, is big compared to what we want to measure. In fact, let me jump right to that. So what we're going to do is measure a bunch of galaxies, right, and then essentially take the mean, or taking the mean is equivalent to projecting this pattern out, see how much of it's there. And remember that galaxies, ideally, modulo the intrinsic alignment that you mentioned, are drawn at random from this distribution, right? And so the mean is going to have a variance in it. because of the shot noise, essentially, of drawing these things at random. So if you want to, what's the variance in that estimated shear going to be? Well, it's going to be the variance of the shapes of individual galaxies divided by the number of galaxies that you're averaging to make the inference. Okay, and just to give you a sense of scale here, this variance is about 0.3 squared. The RMS is about 0.3. In other words, a typical galaxy is already about 30% out of round before you lens it. And then our ambitious lensing surveys, like the LSST that's supposed to start in a few years, will measure the shapes of roughly a billion galaxies. The DES, which is underway right now, we will, quote, only do 2 × 10⁸ galaxies, but it's still a large number. So the variance in the shear, you know, the statistical noise floor in measuring gravitational lensing will be about the square root of this, or 10⁻⁵. Okay. So statistically speaking, we are capable of an extremely precise measurement, keeping in mind that on a typical line of sight, the shear itself is about 0.02. That means that these experiments should be able to measure gravitational lensing, some aspects of gravitational lensing, to 1 or 2 parts per thousand.
You want to be 10 to the 3, not 10 to the
minus. Yes, that's correct. Sorry. Fix that. Right. So what we would like is a mechanism to determine the shear has to get the right answer to a part in 1,000 or better of the shear, or else our measurement mechanism is ruining the precision that we could potentially, that we're being offered by the sky. All right, so we keep that part in 1,000. Remember, it's a small effect to start with, a 1 or 2% shear, but we want to measure it to part in 1,000 accuracy. And the other thing is that if there's some spurious signal, like say the intrinsic alignments or some optical thing that we didn't remove that caused spurious correlations of shapes, if those are above about 10⁻⁵ RMS after we attempt to fix them, then that is also going to dominate our error budget. Okay. And that's why I said, even though the intrinsic alignments are only a few percent of the cosmic lensing signal, it's still something we have to find a way to get rid of.
So at the same thing you mentioned that, I mean, you have to look at different redshifts to separate intrinsic alignment from the lensing effect, the shear effect.
Mm-hmm.
You could also use that to read off kappa, right? Because different redshifts shouldn't have, lensing correlates basically over lenses that different redshifts to each other. So I guess I know this has been done, but I don't know, can it be done at a comparable,
Not yet, but I will show you a way I think it's possible. Yeah. Okay, so we have to assign these spinner quantities to each galaxy. Okay, and there's two ways that almost everybody who does it now does it. One is to very simply take the I is the intensity pattern of the galaxy, and to just measure the second moments. Now, you want these to be the central second moments so that the first moments, which I haven't shown here, are zero, but you can pick your origin to make that happen. And then if you form these two quantities, E1 and E2, by these combinations of second moments, it turns out that they do, in fact, give you exactly the thing you want. The average of these is very directly related to the shear. It's almost perfect. Okay. The problem is that if you have a real image where I has noise in it, and you take this integral to infinity, you get infinite noise on your measurement of E. So it's perfect, but it's perfectly useless too. So what we have to do is get rid of the noise by putting a window function on this integral that constrains it to a region in the vicinity of our galaxy, right? And unfortunately, putting this in ruins the perfection of these unweighted second moment methods. But people persist, including me, with this method because you can make some approximations that let you recover things, but I'll show you those approximations aren't good enough for what we'll ultimately have to do. The other method that you can do and to assign these E's to galaxies is to fit a model. Say you can assume that every galaxy is a exponential disk and a bulge component in some ratio, bulge to disk ratio, that has a certain size and a certain flux in a certain position and a certain ellipticity. Now, these seven numbers here fully predict the appearance of the galaxy. So you can compare the model appearance of the galaxy directly to your data, right? And if you know what the noise in your image is, you can assign a likelihood to the data from your galaxy under the assumption that it has that shape. And so if you choose, say, the maximum likelihood point, you get to assign this E1 and E2. All right, so most of the lensing analyses that are done now use one of those two approaches. How does it work? Okay, well, I want to show you something that's a little ugly. This is from one of the detailed technical papers behind that Canada-France lensing survey result that I showed before, which is the best, most accurate cosmological lensing survey to date. And what this is showing is that let's just look at one of these panels, like right here. This is showing that when they make a fake image, apply shear to it, and then measure it with their software, the shear that they recover is 10 to 20% less than they put into the simulation. Okay, and that's a function of the signal-to-noise of the galaxy, and it gets worse as the signal-to-noise gets lower, which will become clear in a moment why that is. But what you can see is that they have to apply a 10 or 20% kind of ad hoc correction, because the formalism was not exact. There were approximations made, and those approximations are being violated. Okay. Now remember, it was a 3% accuracy on sigma 8, right? And we're aiming to get 0.1% accuracy in the future. So clearly, we have to come up with something that doesn't have these 10% kind of ad hoc corrections that have to be applied. Okay, and another way of putting that, this is just some old World War II radio that I saw at a flea market, and I was just amused because if you look closely in the corner, it says set knobs accurately. And when you're trying to do precision cosmology, you just don't want to have part of your algorithm requiring you to have chosen the right correction factor to high accuracy in order for the cosmology to be correct. Okay. All right, so why are people not doing perfectly? And I just want to give you a list of difficulties with doing this measurement. Okay. The first one is that the image you get is not the image that came down from the sky. The image that you get on your detector has been convolved with what we call the point spread function, which is basically the response kernel of the optics, right? So that your observation is the actual sky convolved with some transfer function or PSF here, right? Now, if you remember what the optics are going to do is going to change the shape of your galaxies and maybe hide a bit of their intrinsic shape. And if you don't remove that, you're actually just measuring the correlation of something of your optics. You're not measuring something cosmic. So you have to, and this PSF here usually has an ellipticity that's much larger than the lensing signal that you're trying to measure, or at least comparable to it. So you have to do this very carefully. And how can you fix that? Well, in the model fitting method, this is actually straightforward because if you have a model, you can convolve it with the PSF before you compare it to your data and assign it a likelihood. So that's actually pretty straightforward. And if you're doing moments, one of those second moment methods, there's a way to fix this as well, because in Fourier domain, this is just a multiplication, right, instead. And so in Fourier domain, I can take my observation, divide it by the transform of this, and I get the sky back. So if I measure those moments in Fourier domain instead of measuring them in real space, I can fix the PSF straight off, right? Okay, what else happens to your data? It falls onto pixels, so instead of a nice continuous image, you get a set of numbers at discrete locations. Well, again, you can actually model that as part of your forward modeling if you're doing model fitting. But if you're good enough to have taken Nyquist sampled data, then you can reconstruct anything you want, even with sampled data, okay, which I won't explain what that means, but I think most of you know. Okay, the real problem is that there's noise in the images as well, right? And this fitting process, or these moments, are a nonlinear measurement of the data. So when you go to assign, say, your maximum likelihood E1 and E2, there is no guarantee that it is unbiased. Maximum likelihood estimators are not guaranteed to be unbiased in this case. And figuring out what the bias is very difficult to do, especially if you need high precision. So this is actually the biggest problem that I'm going to show you how we solve.
Can you elaborate on that? What does it mean for maximum likelihood? I mean, that means that there's something that's missing in the maximum likelihood estimator?
No, it's just that statistically speaking, like, the maximum likelihood does not have to be on average at the true value.
Okay, but that meant you shouldn't really look at the maximum likelihood, you should look at the entire distribution.
So I'm going to talk about how you would do something like that in a way that lets you properly recover. Yeah. And so this is called noise bias, and it's quite, it's something that's why all those CFH tests were getting worse as the signal to noise got lower, right? Because there was more noise, so noise bias should go as a square of the noise, roughly. Well, in this case, I'm actually talking about the likelihood of the shapes, the E's, but since people are using the shapes as an estimator for the shear, it also turns into a bias on the shear estimate. That's pretty close to what I'm going to describe for you in an approach, yeah. Because part of the problem is that people have been too worried about measuring the shape of an individual galaxy and not thinking about inferring the shear. That's right. Okay, another problem that we have is what's called model bias, which is that if you're doing model fitting, you necessarily need a model that has a finite number of parameters to vary. And there is no finite parameterization of galaxies. Galaxies have an essentially infinite variety of appearances if you look closely enough at them, right? You are always using the wrong model if you're using a model to some degree. And the question is that degree enough to get you? And it's been shown that in many cases it can be. Okay, another problem that we have is selection biases, right? The galaxies that even made it into your list of galaxies to start with could be biased towards a certain unlensed ellipticity. For instance, it's usually easier to find galaxies that are aligned with the point spread function than ones that are perpendicular to it. Okay, so you can be messed up before you even start. Okay. Another thing that problem to deal with is missing data. Real astronomical images have cosmic rays on them, things like that, where you end up not knowing what the brightness of the galaxy is at certain locations. You have to figure out how to deal with that. And lastly, there's something called crowding, which is where more than one galaxy is, they're on top of each other in the image. And that's an even bigger problem that I'll mention at the end. So let me just give you the scorecard right now. Here's those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 problems that I mentioned. And here I've just said there's your standard model fitting and your kind of state-of-the-art moments code, both of those. And what do they fix? Well, both of them know how to fix PSF and sampling, but both of them are making ad hoc corrections right now for the noise biases. The model fitting people have to make an ad hoc correction for the fact that their models don't describe the real sky to perfectly. The selection effects, again, is being done with simulations and things, all right? Now, model fitting, by the way, does have a nice advantage that if you don't have data in a certain pixel, you just don't fit to that one. So let me talk now about a new approach, right? Can we start with first principles and get a better way to measure, infer the lensing? And can we do it without having to come, you know, in a mathematically rigorous way so that when we're done, we don't have to go back and do simulations to get an ad hoc correction to our data? And also, whatever we come up with, it should be able to be computable in a finite amount of time. And just to remind you, you know, if you have 10 to the 9th galaxies and it takes one full second to analyze it with one CPU core, even if you buy a 1,000 core cluster, it still takes you 2 weeks to measure all those, right? And 2 weeks may not seem like long, but you've got to do this over and over and over again to get things right. All right, so let's start with something basic. We want to know the probability of given an observation of the sky, that's our image data D, that the lensing took a certain value, all right? So we'll just get Bayes' theorem and flip that around to say the probability of the data given the lensing times the prior probability of the lensing divided by P of D. Next thing I'm going to do is when we're doing galaxy lensing, we can chop up the sky into, you know, where we find the galaxies, right? And modulo the intrinsic alignment that you mentioned, each galaxy is essentially an independently produced shape. So we're going to divide the data up into a bunch of subsets di, right, where I indexes the number of galaxies you found. And there's a term here that I won't say much more about, but the number of galaxies that we found may depend on the shear, and so we have to include this probability too when we sort of compress the data by getting rid of all the empty sky. Okay. All right, so this is the thing then. So we have this formula. We take the log of it, and we would find we have some constant term. We have the log of the prior, which I'm not going to say anything about because our data will hopefully be telling us much, much more than the prior could have told us, so this probably doesn't matter. This term that I said I'm also going to ignore. And then we have the sum of the log probabilities of the individual galaxies. Okay. So we're going to focus on how to figure that out. How would we assign a probability of a picture given a shear in the picture for a single galaxy? Well, there may be some other way to do this, but the way that I know that you could do it is to describe the galaxy with some set of numbers G, okay, which I introduced before. An example would be model fitting, right? Because if you introduce model parameters, then you can split this probability this way and say, first of all, if you choose a G, it fully predicts the appearance of the galaxy in your image. So this term here can just be written as the likelihood of the noise, which is the difference, the noise having generated your image when the underlying image was this one that the model predicts, right? Okay, then there's this other term, and that is saying in this space of ellipticities and sizes or whatever, there's a certain population of galaxies on the sky, and that population shifts when it's lensed. So really what we're doing here is just looking for the population of galaxies to change its characteristics when it's lensed. We're not even demanding any symmetry or anything like that, right? Okay. But this seems like a hard thing to get, right? How do you actually get this distribution of all the properties of all the galaxies on the sky as a function of all the ways that they could have been lensed, right? So what are we going to do about that? So I'm going to draw here because I hope you can see. Let's think of a one-dimensional version here. So I'm going to just draw one parameter that might describe a galaxy. We'll call it E, right? And we're going to make a measurement of that E, and it might have some distribution here. Okay, so here's the probability of the data given that E. And then there's going to be some prior. The unlensed distribution of that parameter look like this. So we want to multiply these and take the integral, right? And then we want to look at all the different, if I were to lens that galaxy and shear it, I might expect that distribution to have shifted. Right? So I have to take this guy, multiply it by this guy now, integrate, and I get my likelihood for a different lensing. So I'd have to do this for all the different Gs. So what are we going to do? Well, how are we going to figure out what this thing is? There's no good theory of galaxy formation. Sorry to insult any galaxy formation theorists here, but if you're interested in predicting the distribution of shapes of galaxies on the sky to high precision from first principles, forget it. You're going to be in business for a long time before you have something that we need. So really, this has to be empirical. We just have to look to the sky to tell us what this distribution is, right? So what I will do is take an image of a sky, of a certain subsection of the sky, and measure some of the galaxies very carefully so that they have no noise on them. And that is a sampling from this distribution. So I'm going to approximate this distribution by a set of delta functions, right, that become more common where, right, it's a sampling. So I can replace this function here with a set of delta functions. Now, normally, you would do some kind of interpolation, right? When you're trying to reconstruct a distribution from a set of samples of it, you have to do some kind of kernel smoothing. But the nice thing going on here is that we're already integrating with this thing here, which is the error distribution of the data. So as long as I have enough samples that my error distribution for my measurement will hit a bunch of the samples, okay, then I don't actually have to do this whole kernel, this interpolation business, that the integral is already set up to do the interpolation for us. The only problem is if this is a really well-measured galaxy, right, it's possible that there would be none of our samples would resemble it, and we wouldn't be able to do this inference. And so here's one, a rare case where it would actually be to your advantage to add noise back to the image for that galaxy so that it does some kind of interpolation for you, the noise.
Or you could just do the interpolation of the sample on the prior.
Yeah, which was almost an equivalent process, yeah.
So. But it's not, one gets better with, one gets worse with improving the error, the other gets better with improving the error. So.
Mm-hmm. So. Right, yes.
When they analyze data, if you have a sleep engineer, they use multivariate analysis. So you take the likelihood function,
mm-hmm.
and you have an algorithm, boosted decision tree algorithm, and you train the thing.
Yeah.
To look for the best distribution. So you could apply that here.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So let's see. So we have this. This is one dimension. This is happening in seven dimensions or whatever, right? That we have to do these integrals. So, okay. So if we make this approximation, if we don't do what you suggested, but go with the just taking the raw samples, this integral, if I approximate this as a series of delta functions, right? It just turns into a sum. Where mu is now indexing the sampled galaxies that I observed on the sky. Okay. And if I observe a galaxy very carefully on the sky with low noise, I can digitally lens it and figure out what its g would have been if it were lensed. So I can express that galaxy's properties as a function of the lensing applied to it. So here we have a very simple formula, actually, that we can use. And I haven't had to make any assumptions about anything except that I have sufficient sampling. So, okay. So here's how we build that prior. And here's the idea. You make a very deep image of the sky. And then each galaxy that you see on the sky, we can assume that somewhere in the universe, there's an equally likely chance we would have seen the parity flip version of it, because the universe is symmetric under that transformation as it is under rotation. So each galaxy that we can observe actually gives us many templates that we can insert into this distribution. Is this a computationally feasible process? Well, remember that we have about 10 to the 9 of these galaxies to look at. This sum is gonna have something like maybe 10 to the 7 or 8 terms in it. So that's 10 to the 17 times you have to calculate this likelihood. And for model building, that 10 to the 17 is starting to be a significantly large number even with a cluster. So it's not clear that this is totally feasible, especially if you have to repeat the calculation at every different G that you're interested in if you wanted to cover the whole space of G. Right? That would be computationally infeasible. But it's called weak lensing for a reason, which is that the G values are small in almost all lines of sight. So you only really need to do this calculation in the vicinity of g equals zero. And so that means that I can do a Taylor expansion, say to second order in g, right? And that the coefficients of the linear and quadratic parts of the Taylor expansion are the first and second derivatives of this expression about g of zero. And those derivatives can just be propagated right into here. Right, and so it turns out that instead of having to do an integral for every g, I can just do 6 integrals and I'm done, because I have 1 integral there, 2 for that one, and 3 for the second derivatives. Okay. All right, and so what I end up with for each of my galaxies is this terms of the Taylor expansion, p, q, and r. I can go back now and I can add up the log probability of all of my 10 to the 9th galaxies, and that sum is here. And this is just a nice Gaussian distribution then, right? If the log of the probability is quadratic. I've used a kind of, I think some bastard version of the central limit theorem here to reduce the problem down to a Gaussian. And this is analytically solvable for the best estimate of the shear and the covariance matrix of the errors on that estimate. Okay. So it all comes through very quickly, and it's actually now going to be computationally faster than the previous methods that I was describing that people are using now. Because all we have to do really is measure these moments. Oh, yeah, good point. Okay. So that was model fitting, right? If we speak of this as model fitting, then we can, you know, when we calculate the likelihood, I was speaking of moments, I got ahead of myself. We have to calculate the likelihood of each model, right, given the data. And the model we can convolve with the PSF before we compare it to the data. So that's taken care of. But we seem to have solved the noise problem, right? The Bayesian approach means that you handle the noise properly. But we still have red here, which means I haven't solved the model bias problem because I'm using a model. I haven't solved any of these other problems yet. And it's not exactly clear yet that I've solved the speed problem if I have to do this forward modeling every time. Okay. All right, so what I would like to do is have something that doesn't use models because galaxies don't obey models. So it's possible that model fitting will be good enough, but I prefer to get rid of it. So what we would like to do is take your picture of the galaxy before we were trying to predict the value of every pixel in every image that you took of that galaxy. What I'm going to do instead is compress the image into a smaller number of quantities. I would like to be able to take the appearance of a galaxy and reduce it to the smallest set of numbers that I think will capture the information about it having been distorted. Okay. So I'm going to look for a vector of compressed quantities m. What's required is, first of all, I have to know what m was before the galaxy passed through the PSF in order for this to work. Right? I have to be able to figure that out. I have to very rigorously know what the error distribution, the noise distribution on m is, so that I can calculate the likelihood of an observed m given a template galaxy's m. And then I don't want to assume a parametric form, and I want my choice of m to capture most of the lensing information. So here's a set of six numbers that I think does that. And this is just going back to what's been done before, which is using moments, right? I just defined six moments that are the flux, the centroid, and then here you recognize our asymmetric friend second moments, and this one are the asymmetric. Here's the symmetric second moment. So if I can measure, and this is something I can measure easily on all my images, and if I divide by the Fourier transform of the PSF, I fix the PSF. So I get pre-seeing measure of m. Now, dividing by the PSF often turns into dividing by zero, which is a bad thing. So you have to insert a weight function here that cuts off the integral before you get to the regions of k-space that you don't know anything about. Okay, but anyway, this set of numbers should capture things. And so now if we go back to where I had the probability of the data given the galaxy, that was a thing we were trying to figure out. Now I'm just going to ask, what's the probability of finding the compressed version of the data given the possible choices of lensing? So I can just plug this back in, m. So for a given galaxy, I'm going to integrate over all the possible moments vectors, the probability of observing my moment given that the true moment is that, and then the probability distribution of the true moments given that there was a shear. Okay. So it's the same as before, it's just I'm using a different representation of the galaxy. This one is non-parametric. And again, if I do a finite sampling of the number of galaxies on the sky, I approximate this as a set of delta functions so that the whole thing looks like this. Now, the nice thing about this choice of moments, one of the nice things is that it's actually linear in the pixel data. And that means that it's easy for me to propagate the errors on the pixel data into the errors on this vector. And in fact, it's just a multivariate Gaussian. So it's easy to figure out and to compute. you have to use the same, yeah. If you custom tune the W, that makes it a nonlinear process, and now it's hard for me to figure out what the error distribution would be. Yeah. Okay, so here's the basic outline. I mentioned before that we were observing some template galaxies. Now we're just going to measure their moments, and then we're going to see how those moments change when we shear them and rearrange them and whatever. Meanwhile, we have our billion target galaxies. For each of those, we just measure their Fourier domain moments, and then we compare this galaxy's moment vector to all the possible templates that represent what it could have been before it was lensed. And again, we can form the probability and then the first and second derivatives with respect to shear. And this is the computationally slow part now, right? Because for each of these, we're looking, comparing it to each of these. But when we're done, we just add up these PQs and Rs and we get our shear estimator. And there are, if you want to know not just the mean shear, but start to make two-point functions, like estimate the shear correlation function, that's some additional challenges. But I think it's doable. Okay. Yeah. Right, right. So rare galaxies are a problem because they don't, the smooth distribution doesn't, has too much noise or is unmeasured. But rare galaxies are rare, so. Okay, so I get to change the model bias. I got rid of the model, right? So now that one goes green. The next one is selection bias. How do I know that I wasn't preferentially picking galaxies that fool me into thinking I had a certain lensing going on? So what I did something wrong earlier, which is that when I gave this Bayesian decomposition, I should have said that here we need to know the probability not just of observing the image given the shear, but we actually need to know the probability of observing that data given that it had that shear and you selected it to be part of the analysis, right? So there's some selection function S. And then let's talk about our moments, okay? Well, we'll use the M's instead of the D's here. And this thing can be written out this way. And so what you need to do is figure out this thing. Now, the problem is that most astronomers barely even know what their selection function is. They'll just take whatever looks like it gave a good answer. And so it's very tough to come up with an analytic description of your typical survey selection function. They can do magnitude limited, but that's one option. But you know, we're free to choose the S that we want. And so we can make our lives a whole lot easier if we were to choose the selection function so that we actually just selected things that had certain values of MI, of the moments, right? The first moment of those six is basically the flux. So if I cut my sample and keep only the things that have M in a certain range of M space, well now, for every galaxy that I selected, it's true that the probability of measuring the moments given the selection and M is actually just equal to the probability of measuring the moments given the M, because the fact that it has these moments just means it was already selected. Okay. So that means that the numerator of that expression actually turns into the same thing that we were using before. I don't have to change it at all. And then there's just a denominator. I have to find out the probability of selecting galaxies under shear. And that also turns into an integral that's independent of any individual galaxy. It's just a calibration factor that goes on all of this. And this turns out to be a truncated Gaussian integral, so it's some error functions or something that you can figure out. Okay. So that works. So I get to turn selection bias green. And now I have two problems left for the last 2 minutes or so here. So missing data, that's where you have a picture of a galaxy, but some pixels were wiped out because they were on a defective pixel or something like that. Okay. Well, if you've taken multiple exposures, it turns out that maybe you already know what should be at that pixel because information from other exposures can recover it. And that means that you took redundant data, which is okay. You know, it came in handy here. But if you were not taking redundant data and you actually have missing information, then you know, by definition, I cannot make a model-free method that can deal with parts of galaxies that are undefined, right? So to fill in missing data, by definition, you have to make some assumption about the way galaxies look, right? So here we're breaking perfection a little bit by doing this, but we could use one of the model-fitting techniques and then just fill in paint the pixels that we're missing. And maybe I'm not so worried about this as I was when I was doing everything by model fitting because it's only the few percent of the missing pixels that I might be biasing with my model instead of the whole image. Right? Or there's other priors that we could use, like there's very interesting compressed sensing techniques that are being developed where you can infer missing parts of images by assuming that they are sparse in some dictionary. Okay? So that's something that we haven't done yet, but we're gonna get to work on. And if I have a galaxy that, you know, a third of its flux is wiped out by a bad cosmic ray or defect, I can just throw that galaxy away and not use it to measure shear. That's okay. Right. As long as cosmic rays don't know to preferentially strike galaxies that were sheared in a certain direction, then I'll be okay. Right. So I got to turn the missing data green. And now the last problem I have is crowding, right? And that one, I have to tell you, I have no answer to because it's a real mess. These overlapping galaxies, well, first of all, if they're at the same redshift, it was only, you know, our feeble human brains that had to decide whether it was two galaxies or one, if they're overlapping. The image of two galaxies is distorted by lensing, you know, the same way that the image of one is. So I don't have to try to split up galaxies that are at the same redshift. But if they're at different redshifts, unfortunately, the lensing acts differently on the two of them, right? Because the distances enter in and all the intervening matter and everything. So those are the real problem, where you have two galaxies projected on the same line of sight. This is a case where model fitting really seems advantageous, right? Because if I do model fitting, I can fit simultaneously to a model that contains two or more galaxies and see which combination fits that image the best. So that's a reason to think about doing model fitting. But another problem is that that assumes that the foreground galaxy is transparent, right? That you could just add those two models up. But we know galaxies are not transparent. So at some level, if the galaxies are close enough to each other, that'll be hard too. You could model that too, but we barely even know what the Milky Way's transparency is, so we're going to have trouble doing that cosmologically, I think. So what we're doing for the Dark Energy Survey, which is my current project that I showed you a picture from at the start, is that that's a relatively shallow survey compared to the LSST, which is Next Decade Survey. And the fact that it's shallow means it doesn't see as many galaxies, which means they're farther apart from each other, which means that overlaps, serious overlaps are rarer. So I think our first approach will be just to throw away the 5 or 10% of the galaxies that happen to overlap a background galaxy. But LSST, the more ambitious project, most of the galaxies will be overlapping something that's also well detected. And so that, I think, is a problem that, and also there are Euclid spacecraft, W4 spacecraft, are scheduled to be built next year to do billion galaxy kind of gravitational lensing surveys. They have better seeing, better resolution being in space, and so they can look, confine their view and their calculations to the central parts of galaxies and maybe be less prone to confusion in LSST, but in any case, this is clearly an area that needs further work. Okay, so let me just summarize with too many words here. This Bayesian Fourier domain method that I described for inferring lensing from images. we managed to come up with something that, you know, without any bad approximations or hardly any approximations at all, except that shear was weak and that I can do this kind of sampling approximation of the distribution. Those were the only approximations I made in saying that we could infer lensing from pictures of galaxies, right? And we've verified that we do reach this part per thousand accuracy on fairly simplified numerical tests. And we've written an algorithm that does these six-dimensional integrals efficiently using a tree structure. We are currently drawing images, measuring them, you know, putting shear into our simulated images, measuring them, seeing if we get back the same thing, and working out the details. And we hope to be applying this method to dark energy survey data by the end of the year. And the other thing I'd like to point out is that nothing in my discussion of this BFD method required that we be breaking a symmetry of the sky. As long as the lensing changes the distribution of galaxy properties in a detectable way, this is how you could find it. And so the whole thing I just described works just as well for magnification as for shear. And magnification has been detected and has been used for interesting science, but I don't think anybody would claim that they've even gotten to the couple of percent accuracy in detecting magnification yet. So that's something that's promising, because there's basically as much information in the magnification as in the shear. And so far, we've only really been pushing the shear as hard. So anyway, that's the basic story. Just here's one example of the tests we're doing. This is the error in the shear that, remember, we wanted to be less than a part per thousand. And here we were testing how good this assumption is, right, that the finite sampling is a good representation of the continuous distribution. And we see that once we get above 10,000 or so templates, we are meeting this part per thousand target. Okay, so this is all stuff that I basically said. So I think that is the end, yeah. Okay, go back to that. Yeah, it depends how serious, how close they have to be together for you to consider it an overlap, but.
Is it still the case that three triple or quadruple and higher
overlaps
are a small fraction?
Yeah, it's to first order Poisson statistics will work, I guess, that if 10% or so of the galaxies have one overlap, then it would be less than 1% that would have three. But you've already thrown it out anyway, so, or at least I have. Yeah. Yeah, 10%. Now, the place where this is really a problem is in galaxy clusters, right? Because then background, you know, galaxy clusters are very crowded and there's diffuse light that covers arc minutes. And I think it's going to be really hard to get these things to work to very high precision on galaxy clusters, which unfortunately is where there's a lot of interesting signal to be had. But yeah.
Right. So what happens in the selection business went by fast? What happens if there's selection on one thing, but the moments are correlated with each other? If you get a bias, let's say, give a concrete example, you know, inclined edge-on disks have fainter flux.
So this six-dimensional version of this should know that, and it should come out correct when you're done. The important thing is to make sure that your selection that you're intentionally making on these moments is that there are no other selections going on that you didn't know about, like that there were galaxies that were too diffuse for you to have put into the list to start with before you cut it down. Yeah. Right, as long as you could describe. I think you have to be able to describe the cut you're making, and so that requires thought.
Yeah.
getting back to the famous organizing model system, bullet cluster.
Mm-hmm.
So able fighters here. The blue patches, you have to do organizing to get the capital merchants back. And so you have to have a model for the morphology of the galaxies behind. So this gets into your question. So my question is, do you have to know how good this is?
Well, it depends what you want to learn from this picture, right? If you just want to learn that there's a blob of matter in a place where there's not a blob of X-rays, you could have your calibration wrong by 10 or 20%, and you've still gotten the main scientific point of the picture, right? So in this case, you know, this was made, nobody's actually used the things I described today, not even me, on real images, but there is real data out there. And I guess I should have emphasized that, you know, for most of the papers that you look at, the errors in the shear measurement are small enough that they're not important for the science that those papers are trying to do, because the smaller surveys to date have bigger statistical errors. So if you're not asking as much of the data, you don't have to be as obsessive. This data actually was a mix of a bunch of ground-based observatories and a little bit of space telescope imaging, but most of the information is coming from the ground.
I like very much the idea that you're trying to infer something about the thing you actually want to know rather than some intermediate value. Mm-hmm. What about going higher up, say, instead of asking about G, asking about 2.5? Anything to gain from that?
So Andrzej Slozar has shown me, and I think he published it, a way that you can use these PQs and Rs to make an estimator for the two-point function. So I don't know. It's nice, as you know, to have a catalog that has some numbers for each galaxy instead of having to make a different catalog for every two-point function that you think you might be looking for. So I think that it's the case that the PQ and R tell you everything you need to know about the shear in the neighborhood of that galaxy, on the line of sight to that galaxy. And then making the higher order statistics or fitting models, I think, can all be done with those as a starting point. Yeah. Right. I think, yeah.
Of course, the problem is that you measure the PSF at different locations
in
the galaxy, and it's not just a constant that varies over the field. It's hard to understand why sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I'll just explain to everybody else that I skipped over another substantial issue. Is I assumed that we knew exactly what that PSF function T was. And how do you know what it is? Well, from the ground, it comes from the stochastic fluctuations in the turbulent atmosphere. So you can't really make a predictive model of it. You just have to look at the stars in your image. See, remember, stars are delta functions, right? So whatever shape they have in the image is telling you what the PSF is. And you only have so many stars. So you have to interpolate the behavior of the PSF to where your galaxy is. And that's another issue. Ideally, you have optics and things where the PSF doesn't change that much across the image. But we have to work on that.
So, I guess maybe I can ask my last question. So this issue of dust is clearly an issue, as you mentioned, if you have galaxies that are blocking each other. But I mean, there is dust just in the intergalactic medium, maybe because galaxies that we don't see. For some reason, it's been ejected in readings. And I guess there is even climate detection of that through this, like in the same way that people decided the matter magnification, there is also a frequency dependence that is attributed to dust. So is that expected, or have you thought about whether that could actually bias any of these measurements?
My guess is that it would be hard, because if you're talking about the dust that's in clusters, it's probably pretty smooth, so it doesn't change the shape of galaxies very much. And even if it were clumpy, would it change them in a way that makes those galaxies tend to look like they're aligned with the center of the cluster. It's right, as if the dust is changing shapes in a random way, then it doesn't bias your lensing estimation. Although it could bias a magnification estimation, right? Which is exactly why
I guess
this was Breese.
There is Breese Bernard.
Yeah.
So it's the largest scale gradients in dust density, I can imagine.
Yeah, I have to think about that. Yeah. Right. I mean, we know that dust is weak because only one person has ever found it, but. Yeah.
Okay. There is a very, very big.
Yeah,
that's
true.
Okay, so before we thank Gary again, so Gary's going to be here all day, and his office is 353. We're going to have lunch, of course, now, and we're taking out dinner and after around 6, so you're all welcome to join us. Let's thank Gary.
Thanks.